This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
But I am worried about reaching a threshold or a tipping point in the Greenland ice sheet stability pretty soon.
That is scientist Jörg Schaefer from Columbia University. We're going to talk about a new paper that rewrites everybody's understanding of Greenland. That research, just published in the journal Nature, uses space-age technology to reveal Greenland has been mostly ice-free for more than 1,000 years, for more than 100,000 years, relatively recently. And it could go back that way again, soon, the author says. In our second half hour, the story nobody wants you to hear about. While the three melted reactor cores from Fukushima are still missing in Japan, burrowing under the ground, the old marriage of Japanese government, media, and industry has united to cover it up. Radioactivity remains in Tokyo and at the city of Fukushima. So why is the government forcing residents back there and cutting off health care? And why, oh why, will we send the world's healthy athletes to Fukushima in 2020 for the Summer Olympics? It's a nuclear nightmare that won't end in our lifetimes. Journalist Robert Hunziker plugs us in with his continuing coverage and insider Japanese sources. All this while the fossil fuel industry and their paid climate deniers have taken control of the government of the United States. It's like a coup. Russia, another world supplier of oil and gas, played its part, raiding the servers of the Democratic Party, the Democratic candidate, and their campaign chair. It's a dirty deal. As a result, scientists at the recent meeting of the American Geophysical Union are gathering to protect their data, and likely many of their jobs. Our first guest, Jörg Schaefer, came from his training in Germany and Switzerland, and he came for the brightest minds and the best technology in the United States to analyze and predict climate change. Now all of that is in doubt. There are several movements in many countries in science to make copies of key climate databases and models to get them out of the United States before the climate killers can take office and take control. But even this misses another threat. Climate science depends on long strings of dependable records, you know that. Weather comes and goes, but climate is understood decade by decade, through centuries, and even millions of years. The United States, through its network of satellites, ocean buoys, and research ships, provides a great deal for scientists in many countries. If there is a break in those critical records, even for 4 years, or heaven forbid, 8, then we will know less and be less prepared. Less prepared for the biggest shift in human affairs in the whole time we've been on this planet. This is the big story. It's hard to imagine. It's hard to grasp. The great but slow movement to get off fossil fuels will continue. Citizens will continue to install solar panels. It pays. The price will continue to drop. While Donald Trump may subsidize the coal industry and get a mine or two going just for show, nobody wants to go back to coal. It will cost more than renewable energy or gas, even without a price on carbon. America might as well go back to making horse carriages or the original Apple computers. Trying to rebuild a coal industry is just going to waste money and time. We don't have that time. Each and every scientist you've heard on Radio EcoShock this fall has brought out another feedback, a greater climate sensitivity, more risk, more reasons why we have to cut carbon emissions drastically, ideally starting about 20 years ago. As our guest Kevin Anderson from the Tyndall Center told us, the next 4 years are critical. Can we stop Greenland from reverting to the bare rock that it knows best? Can we save the remaining Arctic sea ice to stabilize the weather further south, where most of us live? Can we prevent methane geysers from erupting from the seafloor? Can we slow deglaciation in Antarctica until we find a way to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere? Can we save the species threatened? All of this may be up to the rest of the world while America enters a bizarro world, the place where foxes guard the hen house. Or it may become the responsibility where it really belongs, in our own homes, our lives and our lifestyles. If we can't count on the big father of national governments to make it right, the future returns to us. Prepare to organize, prepare to act, to save ourselves and nature. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
During my lifetime, scientists and the popular press portrayed Greenland as long frozen over millions and millions of years. Now that seems doubtful. According to a new study published in the journal Nature, Greenland could have been mostly ice-free sometime during the last million or so years, and maybe it could go back that way. The title is Greenland was nearly ice-free for extended periods during the Pleistocene. Now, is that just a matter for ice geeks? The lead author, Dr. Jorg Schaefer, says the massive Greenland ice sheet might go again, and might go again soon. That would create an ocean several meters higher, rewriting all our maps and cities around the world, so it is important. The global models that predict our climate have not had time to include this new information developed from a cutting-edge scientific technique. Jorg Schaefer is an adjunct professor at the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University. He's also a research professor at the respected Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory just north of Manhattan. Educated in Germany and Switzerland, speaking four languages, Schaefer is a specialist in a rare new technology called cosmogenic dating. We'll get to that as we explore the past, hoping for a mirror to see the future. Dr. Schaefer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Welcome. Thank you very much for the introduction.
So before your new study, how would you summarize the general consensus about how long this great Greenland ice sheet had been there?
Well, I mean, that was always a worry, and it was an open question. But you are right in your introduction that, in general, over the last years at least, it looked like that Greenland might be not our first worry in terms of ice sheet melt. Lots of worries was really focused on the West Antarctic ice sheet that is marine-based. That means the bedrock underneath it is below sea level. And these ice sheets are inherently vulnerable and unstable. Greenland was mostly kind of looked at as a huge ice cube sitting on bedrock. And, of course, Arctic warming is significant. But if you only melt an ice cube from the top, it takes an awful long time to do that, if that is all that's happening. So before this study, we were not that worried, I would say. And I wished, really, looking back, we could have confirmed that. But unfortunately, our results spoke very clearly, and now we are very worried about Greenland.
Why is it so difficult to map out when Greenland was covered with ice and when it was mostly ice-free?
Well, yeah, I mean, it is very simple, but these big problems, everybody wants to know what happened to these ice sheets in the past, because that's really the information that you need to predict what's happening in the future. And so many people try to do that, but it's really complicated because the geological record, the direct record, are these bedrocks underneath the ice, and they are covered by kilometers of ice and are extremely hard to get to. And that's where the primary records sit. And we were lucky enough to get the first piece of rock underneath such an ice sheet in Greenland. And that's this, and when they drilled in the 1990s, finished 1993, the famous GISP-2 ice drilling, where they retrieved an ice core of almost 2 miles for climate, that gave us this fantastic climate record that we have. They drilled into bedrock, and that is just the only sample we have in the moment. And one of my big hopes is actually that we have proven how valuable these archives are and that we are now trying to get to them more frequently and more directly. These bedrocks underneath ice sheets hold the information, and we can map them out and measure them out, and that's what we need to do now.
Yeah, below 2 miles of ice, it's almost as though you got a rock from the moon or something. They're rare. So if it was captured in 1993, why wasn't this type of analysis done until now?
Yeah, that actually the pioneer who was on the ice sheet of this kind of analysis we have applied and that we are experts in, Bob Finkel, he was part of that team in 1993, and he became a good friend of mine when I arrived in the United States in 2000. And he and his colleague Kunishi Tumi, they did, when they retrieved this bedrock core in 1993, already then with the idea applying this technique, which basically gives you a measure of how long was the bedrock exposed to the open sky. So basically was ice free. They tried that in the 90s, and they were super leading back then, and they could measure something, but it was just not precise enough and accurate enough to really make climate and ice sheet histories out of the data. And it just really literally took us 20 plus years to get these methods refined to a degree that they now really release all the climate information and the ice sheet history information that are stored in these bedrocks. So it was really geeky geochemical and analytical development that was needed. And that finally we managed to get there. And with Bob Finkel together, we finally were able to get the pieces of rock, because, I mean, they're kind of super, as you said, extremely precious rocks. So it was not easy to convince the sample assignment committee to give us samples, but finally, thank God, they gave us samples. And now I think the data set speaks for itself. It's very, very internally consistent, very robust, and it tells us a very clear story, even if it's not the story we were hoping for.
So should we try and explain to our listeners what cosmogenic nuclide dating is?
Yeah, we can try that quickly. I know it sounds much more exotic than it is. Really, the basic principle is that the Earth and the Earth's atmosphere is constantly bombarded by primary cosmic rays. These are energy-rich particles or radiation from outer space. These are protons, and then the protons interact with the nuclides, or with the atoms in the atmosphere, and make kind of a complicated nuclear reaction cascade. But the secondary cosmogenic nuclides that form, which are neutrons and muons, they constantly bombard the Earth's atmosphere. And they are still powerful enough to produce certain nuclides that we call cosmogenic nuclides in the Earth's surface rocks. And they are only produced by these cosmic rays. So as soon as you measure them, you know you had a near-surface rock exposed to the open sky. So it's not the sun, it's really coming from the outer space. And these rocks that contain these nuclides have seen the open sky, and these cosmogenic nuclides are produced as a function of time. So that's basically, we are counting these atoms and translate them into time the rock was near the Earth's surface. So exposure dating is really what this is. And in this particular case, we use two radioactive nuclides together. They are produced in a mineral that we particularly like, quartz. And these two nuclides, beryllium-10 and aluminium-26, they are produced basically as twins in that nuclide. However, the one twin, aluminium-26 twin, is produced about 7 times more frequently than the beryllium. And if you then shield the surface after the production, if you, for example, build an ice sheet on top of that surface that, of course, shields the incoming cosmic rays, and then only the radioactive decay is at work, and this ratio, production ratio between aluminium-26 and beryllium-10, that was 7, starts to decay because aluminium-26 decays twice as fast. So if you come after a time T of ice sheet beryl, and you measure something and a ratio between 26 and 10 that is lower than 7, then you can translate that into a period during which this ice sheet was continuously covering that piece of bedrock.
All right. I think we've got enough for listeners there. And listeners, there will be a pop quiz at the end of this interview, so I hope you're taking notes. Okay, now look, I'd like to move on to the big reason, or one of the big reasons that we really care about that, and that is sea level rise. Scientists have various ways of measuring past sea levels. It asks me the question, if Greenland was nearly ice-free in the last million or so years for extended periods, wouldn't that be reflected in several meters of sea level rise? Did scientists find these times? That is, does the time map of sea levels correspond to the possible findings of your study?
Yes and no. Yes, they do. You probably should not directly compare them. So finding past markers of sea level is really tricky. And the longer back in time you go, the trickier it gets and the more harder to analyze these sea level proxy records become. So the biggest discussion in the moment in the sea level community is the last interstadial period. So what we call marine isotope stage 5E, or the Europeans call it the Eemian, I think it's now pretty well documented that this interglacial was even warmer than we have it today. I mean, we'll probably pass that at one point soon, but overall the temperatures seem to be warmer. And there is almost, I think now, agreement that the sea level also was higher during 5E. The problem is you don't really know from which ice sheet that came. So we, of course, know that the Laurentide ice sheet, the big ice sheet, major piece and driver of ice ages, was 20,000 years ago during the last glacial maximum, covering half of the American continent, and then it was decaying over the next 10,000 years. And that coming and waxing and waning Laurentide ice sheet is worth about 120 meters of sea level. But the sea level was another 5 or 6 or maybe even 7 meters higher during the last interglacial. And nobody really knows where this came from. And as I said at the beginning, most people would have put their money on the West Antarctic ice sheet. We don't say in this paper that we have evidence, because we don't. We don't have direct evidence that marine isotope stage 5E, the Greenland ice sheet, was nearly gone. But given our record, it certainly is a possibility that it's happened.
Well, yeah, I want to ask you about that because in the December 16th issue of the journal Science, one of your co-authors, Richard Alley of Penn State, released a new estimate of his sea level rise projections with Michael Oppenheimer, and they project seas 2 meters or over 6 feet higher by the end of this century, but they cite a larger contribution from the Antarctic, not from Greenland. And that got me wondering, is the near-term melt from Greenland one of these things that's high risk but low probability? When I say near-term, I'm talking about this century.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not convinced that where Richard Alley's group comes from, they have identified ice sheet sections in Antarctica that are much more unstable from the ice sheet dynamic side than we were thinking of. So just in general, the areas of concern, if it comes to the Antarctic and the Greenland ice sheet, become bigger and bigger. That kind of early prediction does not include Greenland yet. That was really based on an update of their finding from Antarctica, which they were very concerned about. Probably you would wonder if that an updated prediction curve would be even steeper, because now Greenland is on the map again. But to be clear, right, all we say in this paper for now, and we haven't done any ice sheet dynamics, all we say is the observational record from this really good observation spot that we have gives us direct evidence that Greenland was much more dynamic than we thought before. And we don't push one particular scenario. We just say it was during the Pleistocene for a much longer period than we thought. So more than 200,000 years was ice-free over the last 2.5 million years.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. As you know, I'm your host, Alex Smith. Joining me from Columbia University, New York, is scientist Jörg Schaefer. Along with Richard Alley and others, Schaefer is the lead author in a new paper revealing Greenland may have been close to ice-free relatively recently, and it could unexpectedly return to that state as humans heat the planet with greenhouse gases. Jörg, as you know, a second letter on the Greenland ice sheet was published in the same December 7th edition of the journal Nature. The title is A Persistent and Dynamic East Greenland Ice Sheet Over the Past 7.5 Million Years. Vermont scientist Paul Bierman is the lead author of that. It sounds like a conflict with your findings, is it?
No, it's not. I mean, first of all, it's a big day for our method because we are using the same tools. And I know Paul well as a close colleague, and as we are, he's specialized in making these cutting-edge analysis. No, I don't think so. As we lined out in our paper and also in the news and views in this issue of Nature, these authors reflect the same view. These two studies can be really easily reconciled. So I don't want to talk too much about Paul's excellent paper. They observe erosion under the ice sheet, and they do so in looking in a proxy record, which are the sediment that are reaching the ocean floor of East Greenland. And what basically one of their findings is that there's fluctuations in the intensity of that subglacial erosion signal, but it's what they see in there with the resolution they have, they see it basically being there all the time. So it was kind of continuous. So that means you need some kind of glacial ice on Greenland that does this erosion. So the reason why we titled our paper Extended Periods of Nearly Ice-Free Greenland is exactly that we have one point of observation, which is underneath the GISP2 ice core, It's very central. It's at the point of the highest ice, the ice sheet summit. So all the models agree that this point is one of the latest points to deglaciate. So if Greenland ice sheet decays, the GISP 2 bedrock site is at the very, very end of this deglaciation period, but it's not the total end. So you can deglaciate, or you probably have deglaciated this GISP 2 bedrock site, and there was still some ice on the eastern highlands. If you go from the GISP 2 site to the east, you climb up basically a mountain, and there are the eastern Greenland highlands. And the easiest way to reconcile Paul's and our paper is that Greenland was 90% ice-free, maybe 95% ice-free, but there was still ice on the eastern highlands producing that erosion signal that Paul sees. So no, I don't think so that there's a problem with that at all. It's actually very important to see that, because what this means is that remaining ice in the eastern highlands, that would be also the nucleation point for the new ice sheet. So if you reform it after this warm period, it gets colder, and then you reform the ice sheet, and Paul basically has identified the area where the new ice sheet reforms. So that's a very important constraint for the ice sheet models. And in general, these two observational studies that are published now, we really hope that we kind of together can intensify the collaboration with our ice sheet physics colleagues and the ice sheet modelers and come up with a new generation of more realistic Greenland ice sheet scenarios, which will be more dynamic. And please note that Paul's paper also has the word dynamic in the title, which is very important. So.
Well, I guess the question most of my listeners are going to be asking themselves is, Jörg, do we have any idea how fast Greenland could lose substantial amounts of ice?
And that my answer in the moment is no, we don't. What I think we can say is that the existing Greenland ice sheet models that we have are too conservative and too stable. So whatever we will produce in the next year or two in terms of new and more realistic and more dynamic Greenland ice sheet model simulations, this will be a significantly more aggressive picture in terms of ice loss. And we don't really know the process yet, I think. I mean, that will be the big discussion point. So it feels to me that we are missing something either in the paleo climate scenarios that are driving these ice sheets or in the ice sheets themselves. I cannot tell you what this is, and I really cannot tell you the time scale about Greenland deglaciation before we have identified the physical process. But I am very optimistic that, I mean, probably my colleagues, and hopefully with our help, will identify that. And they will identify if it's the climate forcing that was much bigger than we think, which Richard Ellie favors, or if it's something in the ice sheet physics that we are really missing. So we'll see. So no, in the moment, I would not like to put out any number that has really no basis in the moment. But I am worried about reaching a threshold or a tipping point in the Greenland ice sheet stability pretty soon. We have actually more work going on. I don't know if you have a question for that, what we are doing now as a next step.
I'm interested. Please tell us.
So in the moment, we are basing all our, this paper is based on the beryllium and the aluminum exclusively. There's also another nuclide produced, not in quartz, but in feldspar, chlorine 36, that has, again, less than half of the half-life, so it decays twice as fast as aluminum. And we are in the moment going through the very tedious process to measure that. And that should give us actually, hopefully, an idea that should answer us the question if the Greenland ice sheet was gone over the last 500,000 years, so on the shorter time scale. And that is really critical, because then it hopefully can give us a better idea, was it ice-free during the last interglacial or not, where we have a lot of other proxy data that we could use then to really estimate and quantify the sensitivity of the Greenland ice sheet. But that's going on. This is all happening in the next year or so. Again, before I'm giving out a number now that I cannot hold, I would rather wait for a year, and then we are much further. And then I'm pretty optimistic that we can give you a much better answer and a really informed answer about that crucial question. There's no question that we know how important that is. But that's also the reason why I would, as scientists, rather stay conservative and make sure that we have the right information.
I understand. Well, we need more research, and you've said in a video made for Columbia University that it's just a matter of funding to find out when and how fast Greenland could revert to its low ice state. And I'm wondering, do you have worries about funding now that the incoming American administration is loaded with outright climate deniers who want to chop off climate change research? Could that affect your work or your observatory work? Or can private donors fund this research?
Yeah, I mean, that no question, would the decrease or suppression of federal funding of climate research would certainly have an effect and would slow down things. However, I mean, the U.S. is not alone. What it would really do primarily, it would cut off the leadership of the U.S. science community in that field. If you made these kind of first kind of breakthrough studies that clearly show that these techniques are available, and I mean, the U.S. is blessed to be in clearly in the leading spot also from the analytical side in the moment that, I mean, you need these crazy machines, kind of mass specs coupled to a particle accelerator to measure these nuclide systems, and the U.S. has just simply the two best facilities on Earth, maybe full of, including one from Australia that we are working with for the Chlorine 36 project. That's Keith Fifield at ANU. So, but these three are clearly leading, and if the funding would go down significantly, then we would lose these leadership. But these questions, the climate system is so much bigger than an administration or one or even two election cycles. People will work on this. It will be painful for me personally, but it will not halt the overall science in that. And again, I mean, many of us are so committed. This is really the forefront, one of the forefront problems that we need to tell society, and we have to, politicians have to prepare society, not only in the U.S., but also in the U.S., for what is coming there. And I really think we have now opened a new chapter where we have these tools in place to do these direct studies. And, I mean, drilling through kilometers of ice to get through bedrock, this is certainly not cheap, but it's also not outrageously expensive. So, I mean, you're not talking mega projects like a NASA mission or something. This is mid-funding level, I would say. I'm still hoping, simply because I had such a wonderful journey here in the U.S. science world so far. Maybe I'm just too naive, but I just cannot believe that this is now stopped and taken away from us, now that we are basically in a position to continue to lead and finish this job with the U.S. colleagues here.
Yes, just as we can find out. You know, I found your letter, Jorg, in Nature very disturbing, even on a personal level, because once again, the entire picture we had of the stability of nature has been questioned, if not thrown out, and it takes us closer to an emerging state of chaos. Do you think that's where we're headed, Jorg? Is it climate chaos coming?
I don't like this word climate chaos. I generally don't like I stay away from everything that kind of could trigger hysteria. Do I think this will be one of the biggest challenges, or the biggest challenge maybe, that our overpopulated planet faces in the next, not 200, but in the next 50 years? Yes, I do think this is correct. This is true. I also do think that it is not completely too late yet. There is a lot of progress in that field in many aspects. This kind of science and understanding of what is happening had made huge jumps forward. Admittedly, most of the big findings we have to report are worrisome. But then again, I'm just on the longer time scales. I'm not willing to believe that this is a challenge that mankind cannot stem. But we have to really look into it. And what we cannot afford is to behave like it's not a problem. And any state and any government that would do that will just simply fall back behind others. And that's certainly not what we want in the U.S.
No, we want to make America great again in the science community as well.
You said that. Well, we are pretty good, actually. America was not in a bad shape as far as I can tell. And in the science world, that's one of the reasons why I am and my wife, she's also a research professor here in the same institution, and also teaching at Columbia. We are both Germans, and we are both here and have decided to raise our kids because of this incredible depth and breadth of scientific intellect that is not only here at the West. I mean, Columbia is a fantastic place, but in general, there are many areas and many institutions in the U.S. that are just absolutely world-leading in that aspect. So we don't want to lose that. No, we don't.
Is there anything you would like to add?
No, it's just this is a personal, almost personal aspect here. There is an upcoming center here at Columbia called the Center for Climate and Life. And first, I would like to add, if that is possible, that I'm also a scientist of the Center of Climate and Life. And that is one of the big centers that looks into the opportunities to find private funding for these kind of researches. At one point, you kind of asked me if there is chance to find private funding for these projects. And I think at least seed funding, this hopefully would be possible.
It should be possible because, you know, Jeff Bezos of Amazon and Bill Gates of Microsoft and others, including Richard Branson, have just announced a new $1 billion formation of a company to develop renewable energy and low carbon energy. So I could see that perhaps private funding will replace some of the government funding if needed.
Yeah, let's hope. Let's hope at least as a bridge. I mean, again, the kind of the U.S. also, the funding rate didn't go up as we were hoping for geoscience in general and for climate science, but it still was a very functional system, and it still is a very functional system. So I'm not one of these people who say if you have to, that federal funding doesn't work anymore, we need private. But now with the recent developments in politics, there's no question that it would be certainly a good idea and good to know that there are private philanthropists who are willing to at least bridge these kind of the science that leads into the answer of these kind of questions. And I just wanted to acknowledge that affiliation to the Center of Climate and Life, because that will be hopefully a very important player here in Colombia.
Is it already up on the web or is it coming?
It's up on the web. I send you a link.
Okay. I'll put that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Listeners, we've been hearing about a new factor in the climate threat. Instead of being a steadfast giant of ice, science can now reliably show that parts of Greenland have been ice-free in the not-so-distant past. It could revert to that state with catastrophic consequences as global coastlines flood. Our guest is Dr. Jörg Schaefer. He's from the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. We've been discussing the startling paper, Greenland was nearly ice-free for extended periods during the Pleistocene. That was published in the journal Nature on December 7th, 2016. Find all the links you need to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for talking with us, Jörg Schaefer.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Well, I guess the triple meltdown nuclear disaster at Fukushima, Japan, is all over. It must be. We're not hearing much about it, right? But as we're about to find out, the silence about the continuing horror in Japan is no accident. Robert Hunziker has some news even hardened Fukushima watchers missed. Robert's the freelance environmental journalist whose work is published all over the world. This latest article can be found in the online magazine Counterpunch on October 31st under the title Fukushima Cover-Up. Robert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
Good. I'm glad to have you here. Let's dive right into the cover-up you write about when the mainstream doesn't. I'd like to tell listeners that the Asahi Shinbun newspaper is like the New York Times of Japan, except Asahi has three times the circulation, over 7 million daily versus about 2 million for the New York Times. So, Robert, what happened at this huge daily newspaper in Japan when it comes to coverage of Fukushima?
Well, they were shut down. In fact, the year 2013 is the big cover-up year in Japan. That's when the Orwellian dream came true and the land of the rising sun decided to go to 100% totalitarianism. Of course, Abe's administration came in the year before in 2012. 2013 is the big cover-up year. They decided to put a cover on this entire nuclear disaster. And what happened with the Asahi Shimbun newspaper is that they had dedicated a staff of 30 journalists to cover the Fukushima nuclear disaster. And they were shut down in 2013. Now, they had written articles criticizing the state secrecy law. There are three things that happened in that year, 2013. The point in the direction of major cover-up. One is the shutdown of the journalistic team at Asahi Shimbun newspaper. Secondly, Japan passed a secrecy law, basically that says whatever an accuser claims to be secret is secret as long as they're a bureaucrat that makes the claim. And as a matter of fact, taking it to a further extent, If you're a journalist and if you simply inquire about what's designated as a state secret, you could be subject to going to jail in Japan. The third thing that happened is that they were awarded the Olympics, which is the greatest cover ever for a major nuclear disaster, because it makes it appear to the world that, hey, everything's A-OK. Come on over, hundreds of thousands of people, to Fukushima, where, in fact, they plan on having some of the Olympic events, like baseball and soccer. And they'll be fed food from Fukushima. Fukushima was one of the great agricultural regions of Japan, by the way. Meanwhile, you've got an active nuclear plant that is active fission, atom splitting. It's not likely to ever be recovered. When I say never recovered, you have 600 tons of melted fuel from the three reactors that had total 100% meltdown. And according to Greg Jesko, who was the former head of the U.S. NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, it's not likely they will ever recover that. And nobody knows where the fuel is. So this is something that's very radioactive, and it will be for decades. So this is one of the biggest cover-ups of our lifetime. It's one of the biggest industrial disasters of our lifetime. There are going to be a lot of people who suffer. And, of course, another part of the cover-up, Alex, I've seen several articles in the Wall Street Journal, in the New York Times, in Forbes, where these pro-nuke writers talk about, well, there are no deaths, so maybe one death as a result of this meltdown. And they go on and on about how this really shows how safe nuclear power really is. Well, baloney. I have several contacts I know of in Japan who gainsay that. The mayor of Futaba, and I've written about this several times. In fact, I would recommend to your listeners that they read an article that I published, had published in September of 2015. The title of it is The Fukushima Fix. The Fukushima Fix. That is a very thorough article that goes into a lot of what we're talking about. But in terms of deaths in Japan, there have been many. The mayor of Futaba, which is one of the cities in the Fukushima area that was evacuated, actually made a public statement at one point that many people are dying and that his own government is lying about it. There's a Buddhist temple not too far from the Fukushima nuclear disaster. There's a monk there named Kinoshita, and he has cremated ashes, several ashes of workers from the Fukushima plant. And of course, what happens at the Fukushima plant is that TEPCO, which is Tokyo Electric Power Company, doesn't report deaths of workers. And they say there haven't been any. Well, the reason they do that is twofold. One is that they use subcontractors to do all the cleanup work. Well, the subcontractors are not obligated to report the deaths on behalf of TEPCO. Secondly, the second thing that happens is if you're a worker and if you've been zapped by way too much radiation, and if you get radiation illness, do you think you're well enough to go to work before you die, to die at the work site? No, you're not. You're in bed suffering, and that's when you die, and they don't report it. A journalist, independent journalist in Japan named Meiko Ashidori, who I've had contact with, interviewed a nurse who resigned from TEPCO, and that nurse told her that there have been many, many deaths of workers at the plant that are not reported. Now, it's interesting, going back to the Orwellian dream that's being realized here in the land of the rising sun. Meiko Ashidori of Free Press Corporation in Japan was interviewed in Germany about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And one of the things she said really struck me. She said, there's one thing that really surprises me here in Europe. It's the fact that people here think Japan is a very democratic and free country. Well, it's not. It's a totalitarian state that has been put together over the last couple of years to hide the biggest disaster in human history. I wrote an article about a gentleman, speaking of deaths as a result of this, named Dr. Josh Parks. And the title of the article, and the article was in June of 2015, title of the article is Dr. Josh Parks' Courage at Fukushima. He was a missionary, and he had worked for decades in Japan with the indigent people in the streets and helping people out. He actually set up a a street chapel for the homeless, in fact, and revered among the people that they're homeless people in Japan. And he and his partner immediately went to help when Fukushima took place. He passed away from cancer, as did his partner a couple of years ago. And I wrote a memorial to him. And that's the article I just referred to. So this is a ongoing disaster that is not going to quit during our lifetime. And it's going to have unbelievable impact for years and years. You know, Alex, in that article that you mentioned at the top of this show about my most recent, the Fukushima cover-up article, I intentionally put two paragraphs at the end of that article that I think will really ring a bell with people. And it talks about Chernobyl because, you know, Chernobyl happened 30 years ago. And I thought it was fascinating that the USA Today newspaper on April the 17th of this year had an article entitled Chernobyl's Legacy, Kids with Bodies Ravaged by Disaster. Kids with Bodies Ravaged by Disaster. And what they said in that article is that there are about 2.4 million people today in the Ukraine that they're registered with the health ministry to receive ongoing Chernobyl-related health care. And of those 2.5 million people, nearly 500,000, actually it's 453,000, are children, none of them born at the time of the accident. Their parents were children in 1986. And these children have a range of illnesses, respiratory, digestive, musculoskeletal, eye diseases, blood diseases, cancer, congenital malformations, all kinds of abnormalities. And here you have a newspaper, USA Today, which is considered kind of a neutral magazine. I don't know if they have a real political bent to them or not, but they typically aren't political. And they put out that article. That, to me, tells the whole story.
Well, you know, we've heard about that from Dr. Helen Caldicott. We've had her on the show. She's talked about transgenerational damage of nuclear exposure. And there were put downs and catcalls from official experts in several countries. And the thing is, you know it's basic science. It's taught in every biology class that radiation causes transgenerational damage to fruit flies, to animals. But somehow the Japanese want us to believe that humans are exempt.
Yeah, they do, don't they? Yeah, isn't that amazing? One of the saddest things, too, Alex, is that they're prematurely. They're going in and they're going ahead and they're having people that had evacuated move back in. And what the Abe government's done is when they evacuated 160,000 people from that greater area around Fukushima, they did provide compensation to those people. Well, now they're saying as soon as the cleanup is finished in your area, your compensation stops. So now you're with your family that had to leave 5 years ago, go live in a schoolhouse or wherever it was, abandoned from your home. Now they're not going to give you compensation any longer. Your whole life has been upset, and they're going to move you back into an area where they say that it's been cleaned up. Well, I'm here to tell everybody who's listening, those areas are not decontaminated the way they say they are. And how do I know that? I know that because of Greenpeace. And I suggest a film that people can go to on YouTube. It's called Fukushima Living with Disaster. Fukushima Living with Disaster. If you put that into YouTube, you'll see about a 20-minute film that actually shows in real time radiation tests taking place by Greenpeace workers in Japan in areas where the Japanese government claims that it's been decontaminated and the people can move back in. And there are hotspots all over the place. The other problem, Alex, with the whole Fukushima area is it's a myth that the government can go in and clean this up. They've got 30, 40,000 workers who've gone out and tried, and you got to give them credit for making an effort, but they've taken topsoil and put it into these one-ton black bags. They've got enough black bags full of this contaminated soil that could extend end-to-end from Los Angeles to Tokyo, and they've only got about half the job done, but yet the job they've done is not complete at any rate. There are hot spots everywhere. 60% of Fukushima is forest, mountains, hills, valleys, meadows. None of that has been touched, and that all runs back onto the contaminated areas over time. The other thing that's just been recently uncovered that is really a disaster, There are 10 major dams in Fukushima that provide the water supply for agriculture and drinking. And they have discovered at the bottom of those dams extraordinarily high levels of cesium-137, which is one of the isotopes that's produced when you have nuclear fission. Cesium-137 is a million times more poisonous than anything you can think of. 1 gram, which is about the size of a dime, of cesium-137 spread evenly over 1 mile, 1 square mile, will make that uninhabitable for 100 years, 1 gram. Now, at the bottom of these dams, very bottom of the dams, it has accumulated, and the readings are, in some instances, 30,000, some instances, 70,000 becquerels per kilogram. Drinking water standards in Japan now are 200 becquerels of radioactivity per kilogram. And here you've got 30,000, 60,000. Now, what the authorities have decided is that at the very top water level of these dams, it's a lower amount. So they're continuing to use it for both drinking water and for agriculture. They should shut down that entire area the same as Chernobyl did. Chernobyl has a 1,000 square mile prohibited region that's going to be shut down for maybe hundreds of years. So it's a story that hasn't stopped. It's not in the news. It hasn't stopped, and it only gets worse because they cannot locate a major meltdown, the corium that's sizzling hot, and that puts out isotopes that can actually, if it burrows through, if it has burrowed through the containment vessels and into the earth, I don't think anyone knows what will happen. We've never had this happen before in the history of humankind. This whole thing's an experiment, and they're playing with fire, and here you've got a totalitarian government now that's playing with people's lives.
Well, why don't we talk about what's going on at the Fukushima site? Back in May, you wrote an article for Counterpunch, reported by Zed Magazine as well, saying Fukushima flunks decontamination. They've got these tanks, and then they've put in more tanks, and then hundreds more tanks, all full of radioactive water that they've supposedly filtered. I don't know what they're doing with the filters, because they're really reconstituted to interiors of nuclear power plants. What's happening with all of that? Is it flowing into the Pacific yet?
Well, they did put up an ice wall. They tried to put up an ice wall that surrounded the facilities, claiming that they could stop it from flowing into the ocean, but the ice wall's failing now. So, no, they haven't been able to stop that. That's another historic event that's taking place. The amount of radioactive water that has gone into the Pacific over the last 5 years is just unimaginable. Humankind's never seen anything like this happen before. What are the consequences going to be? You know, there's a lot of speculation about that. And I think one of the really strange coincidences, Alex, is that even though you've got organizations like Woods Hole Oceanography here in the United States, which is highly respected in terms of evaluating the quality and quantity of what's in the ocean, for example, they take tests all the time. They're saying that we don't have dangerous levels of radiation in the Pacific Ocean around the West Coast, is what they're saying. On the other hand, I think it's really a strange coincidence that you had so many animal deaths in the Pacific over the last few years, whales and all kinds of, you've had starfish that have been melting, and strange things are happening in the Pacific Ocean. So it really makes you wonder, doesn't it?
It does. Now, as you mentioned, pretty soon we're going to hear all the tourist hype and national promotions for the 2020 Summer Olympic Games in Japan. They're slated for Tokyo, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But surely somebody is joking when they propose to hold some events in the radioactive city of Fukushima. Who suggested what, Robert?
Well, let me just say this. When the announcement was made that the 2020 Olympics would be held in Tokyo, Nature magazine put out an editorial, and let me just read to you one short paragraph in their announcement on the heels of that Olympic award to Japan. Why would any sane organization vote to host a global event that brings hundreds of thousands of people to a location just a short distance away from a collapsing nuclear power plant that is utterly and completely out of control with no end in sight? When I first read that, I thought, if anything's ever really going to stick with me about the upcoming Olympics, that's it. And that's what should really be broadcast to people, because who put them up to the Olympic thing? I think it's all a charade. It's a cover to try to make it look like, gee, this thing's really not that harmful. It's not that dangerous. And we've got it cleaned up, on and on. And I think there's a consortium involved here of the U.S., I'm guessing, the U.S. authorities on nuclear power in Japan, and certainly the Abe government, and also the Olympic Committee. Why would the Olympic Committee select Tokyo, who bid $5 billion for the Olympics, when Istanbul bid $20 billion for the same Olympics? There is, by the way, an ongoing investigation in France by some prosecutors of funds that were paid to some parties somehow related to the Olympic Committee, and I don't know much more about it than that. But it looks like it's just part of the big cover-up, and that's what it really, I think it really is. And it's a sad, sad tale, because you're going to have Olympians and tourists from the United States and elsewhere around the world, France, Germany, you name it, that are going to the Olympics, assuming everything is well. How can everything be well when they have three 100% meltdowns and they don't even know where the cores are located yet and what's happening, and they can't even get close to those buildings or they'll get fried? It's just unbelievable. It's really hard to accept this.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with American freelance journalist Robert Hunziker. You know, Robert, I recorded so much of what happened right from the first day of that so-called accident. I put out an emergency podcast that day. I recorded all sorts of TV stuff, all sorts of radio and print. It's all on my hard drives. And there's no doubt in my mind, and plenty of records to show, that Tokyo itself was showered with radioactive material, which lodged itself in the underwater world of Tokyo. People don't know much of that city is built on reclaimed land from the sea, and there's all sorts of little waterways under it. And after that dousing, the hills around and the waterways flowing into Tokyo were periodically replenished with doses of radioactivity following the seasonal rains. And I'll bet that's still happening. But as you say, with official secrecy and a docile press, we'll never know.
That's right. And you know, there are people, Alex, of real stature in Japan who are adamantly opposed to what's happening. For example, former Prime Minister Koizumi, who was one of the most popular prime ministers ever in the early 2001-2007 period, he held a press conference just about a month and a half ago where he said that Prime Minister Abe lied to the Olympic Committee. Koizumi is against nuclear power in Japan. Prime Minister Kan, who was the prime minister when the event happened, has spoken out against more nuclear power. We've got to get rid of nuclear power. Ambassador Murata in Japan has been leading the effort to get the Olympics out of Japan. We can't have them when we have this disaster in our backyard. So it's kind of interesting. There are some lone wolves out there, but they're people of high stature saying, get rid of it. We cannot. And you know, the country has done okay without nuclear power for 5 years, hasn't it?
It has. It's been doing pretty well. Now, I noticed that the Japanese have just announced in October that they're giving up on their breeding reactor at Monju. That's another multi-billion dollar nuclear mistake. It was supposed to make plutonium fuel for Japanese reactors. And in fact, reactor number 3 at Fukushima was burning this MOX fuel that was laced with plutonium. And did you know, Robert, that after reactor number 3 blew sky high one day, we can all watch the footage of that in 2011, plutonium was found loose on the reactor grounds and even outside the plant facility.
Oh, my word. This is really, it's such a scandalous situation, Alex. And you know, the thing is, it just doesn't seem to ring true with people, because I think they don't want to face up to it or something. I don't know quite what it is, but they're getting away with murder. They really are. And you have to wonder about the character of the world's leadership when these kind of things happen, don't you?
I do. And I think this is one of two big reasons why humans really can't use nuclear power. And one of them is our attention spans about 30 seconds. While plutonium's dangerous for at least 500,000 years, there's no civilization even come close to 1,000 or 2,000 years, much less that length of time. But the other thing is the very thing that we began with, the need for secrecy in authoritarian governments. Governments that develop nuclear power need an authoritarian core to protect the plants and a strong army, and that expands into a big loss of transparency. I mean, Robert, What do you think would happen if you or I go down to a public road in the United States, we set up a camera, and we just sit there for a couple of hours taking pictures of a nuclear power plant?
You'll be investigated as fast as you can click your fingers.
You bet. There'll be people around in black cars. We'll go on some kind of list. Maybe we're on some kind of list right now for talking about it. It's come to the point where environmentalists have been labeled terrorists, partly in order to protect the nuclear industry. And so when we criticize the nuclear industry, well, we're really bad guys. We're unpatriotic. But look at what happened to Japan. The country is going bankrupt for a lot of reasons, not just nuclear power, but that certainly added fuel to that fire of how badly they are financially in Japan.
Well, they're very badly in bad shape in Japan. I wrote an article about this for the World Financial Review out of London last January, talking about the challenges in Japan on two fronts. One is the nuclear disaster itself, and secondly is their fiscal status. Their debt to GDP is 200%. We're at 100%. Their debt situation is worse than Greece's, by the way. But what's happened is, with this new quantitative easing that the central bankers have discovered, they're now eating themselves. Their central bank has purchased over half of their government debt, and they'll just keep doing it. And I don't know where that ends up. But they're on two slippery slopes, one on a fiscal basis, and the country could go broke. They really could. In fact, The Economist wrote an article about this about a year ago, about the danger of Japan going bankrupt. So two slippery slopes. One is they could go bankrupt. Secondly, unless their central bank can just buy all their bonds, I guess maybe they'll do that, and who knows where that ends up. And secondly is they have three China syndromes on their hands, where they have total nuclear meltdown and they don't know what to do about it. Could things be any worse for the Olympics in 2020 than that?
Good times for all. Do you have sources you'd like to pass on for listeners who want to keep track of the ongoing Fukushima nuclear disaster?
Well, I'm not real active in that regard, but I'm on Facebook, Robert Hunziker, and then also Twitter at Robert_Hunziker. The last name spelled H-U-N-Z-I-K-E-R. And when I publish articles, I put them on those sites. So far, I've published about 22 articles over the last year and a half on this situation. And I'm going to continue to stay with it because, Alex, I've developed some really, really good sources in Japan that I communicate with that I think give me good information. I think it has to be out there.
I'll get some links in my own show blog at ecoshock.info so listeners will be able to find you and find your articles. We've been talking about another cover-up of the nuclear disaster that is Fukushima, Japan. Our guest is Robert Hunziker. I've read his green investigative reporting all over the net, and it's published all over the world. Robert, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex, and I'm so pleased you're exposing this.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.